Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. Well, after Tony Gosling was labelled a conspiracy theorist by Venue Magazine last week, we were afeard here at Dialect HQ that he might lie low and go mainstream on us, but no, not a bit of it. This week he brings us an interview with author of Secrets and Lies and a History of Organised Crime, David Southwell. We also have part three of our serialisation of famous journalist John Pilger talking about Obama's administration so far. As ever, Malcolm Greaves reads another instalment of John Fothergill's Diary of an Innkeeper, a real-life diary of one man's adventures running a pub near Oxford in the 1920s. Jess Marks is here to enlighten us with what's on in Bristol this week, so stick around for that later on. We've got a bit of poetry from Katie as well. First over to our interview with David Southwell, courtesy of Tony Gosling. He's the author of Secrets and Lies and a History of Organised Crime, and eagle-eared listeners will of course know that we serialised a history of organised crime, and Malcolm Greaves read that, and David Southwell apparently got in contact with us to sort of congratulate us on it and said, well done. So I thought I'd give a little taster of kind of what kind of thing he writes about. I've got Secrets and Lies in front of me, exposing the world of cover-ups and deceptions, and there's lots of options, but I picked one that's kind of slightly topical in light of the Lockerbie guy going back to Libya. The headline for this little conspiracy theory that he's written about here, The Missing Police Notebooks from the Lockerbie Crash Investigation, and it gets a little pricey. On the night of the December the 21st, 1988, Pan Am Flight 103 exploded over the Scottish border town of Lockerbie, killing 270 people, including 11 on the ground. It later emerged that the plane had been brought down by bomb placed in a suitcase in the cargo hold, making it the largest act of terrorism against the US before 9/11. The Lockerbie bombing was also Britain's worst air disaster and resulted in Scotland's largest ever murder investigation. After a three-year joint investigation by the Scottish Police and the FBI, Libyan intelligence agent Abdel Basit Ali al-Magrahi was charged with the bombing and in 1996 was eventually convicted of murder and sentenced to 27 years in prison. Nagging doubts remain over the case, especially when it emerged that key elements of the evidence had been destroyed. Many police officers were disturbed by the presence of Americans at the crash site and were told by senior officers that they were not to enter material about American activity in their notebooks. In 2000, Labour MP Tam Deal revealed that a former constituent, WPC Mary Boylan, had come to him to express her concerns over the destruction of police notebooks belonging to officers involved in the initial stages of the Lockerbie crash site investigation. Almost 11 years after the event, Boylan had been asked to give evidence to an inquiry over Lockerbie, so the retired WPC had phoned Livingston Police Station to ask for her notebook. She was told it had gone missing, despite the legal requirement to keep it safely stored. She then learned that the notebooks of Lothian and Borders Police who had been at the crash site had been destroyed. In the House of Commons, DL asked, who gave the instruction for the destruction of the notebooks in the biggest murder trial in Scotland? It was a question that was not answered. What happened to the remains of a suitcase belonging to Joseph Patrick Curry, a member of the US Army Special Forces, which Boylan recovered from the crash site, also remains a mystery. Like the police notebooks, it too is missing. Okay, well that's a little taster of something written by David Southwell from Secrets and Lies, and here is Tony Gosling interviewing the said gentleman.
My name is David Southwell, I'm the author of several books, including History of Organised Crime and Secrets and Lies. The way I really got into this, I think it was as a child I had a natural curiosity, and behind the woods in which I lived in Essex was a microwave relay tower, which sort of really dominated the landscape. And in the 70s, microwave relay towers weren't very common. And it piqued my curiosity. And I went through a whole of my childhood asking absolutely everybody, what is this? What's going on here? And eventually, in the very early 80s, I read a book by Duncan Campbell, which explained that the bit of the landscape I'd been most puzzled by and spent 12 years sort of growing up in the shadow of was actually something called part of Backbone Britain, which was the communications system which was set up to survive a nuclear war and to provide the command structure and communication structure in a post-nuclear Holocaust situation. And really from that sort of first sort of discovering my first state secret, as it were, my relationship to it, I think really kept a interest and piqued an interest in sort of following those type of stories. And from my childhood onwards, I think I gravitated towards journalism and research, and really it held a fascination, which sort of became a lifelong fascination.
So how did that become an interest in the Mafia?
Well, for me, the Mafia is a really good way of looking at what I call the conspiracy of the everyday. Organised crime is a really great model of how a lot of corporations and a lot of government collusion with corporations actually works. So it's a very good way of talking to people and examining how the hidden powers help shape our everyday reality and are the conspiracy of the everyday. And organised crime is a very visible way of looking at it and a way of researching it. But I think the model behind organised crime has a lot of parallels which are very translatable into other areas.
But organised crime isn't really very visible, is it? Most people, organised crime may be going on, but they may well not know it's there.
I think organised crime is actually incredibly visible. What you don't perceive quite often is the chain of organised crime. You're very much aware of the dodgy gear being sold to you. Everybody knows somebody who is dealing something or the other. What we don't often think about is the structure behind that. But actually investigating that and actually laying some of that bare and starting to see some of those relationships isn't that hard to do.
So what is the structure behind it then? I mean, you may see a drive past a drug dealer on the street or whatever, but how high does it go, structure behind the dealer on the street?
These days, even the most localised form of organised crime will be part of a structure which will lead to a transnational criminal organisation. That transnational criminal organisation, what you are seeing on your local street in your local area, will have an impact not just at a national level in this country, but in several other countries. And the level of collusion and integration with legitimate business and government is so integrated that what you see happening goes all the way back to UK government, government in other countries. You know, if we're talking about dealing with cocaine, it will have an impact in Colombia, China, Australia, Brazil. The chain is so integrated now that your local organised crime, that tip of the iceberg, is just the start of a huge chain of consequence which will circle the world.
Is it possible, do you think, for the police to smash these crime rings?
I actually really believe that the basis of, if you want to say, dismantling organised crime, making an impact on organised crime, it's never about more police numbers, it's never about increased budgets, it is never about increased powers. If you talk to, as I have done, anybody who is highly placed in a transnational criminal organisation, there are two things which really, really worry them. One of which is tackling prohibition, because prohibition is one of the biggest sources of any criminal activity in criminal market. And it's the other really big issue for them is actually making business much more difficult for them to do, which is all about tackling poverty. Tackling poverty at a local level, tackling poverty at a global level.
Why does that make business more difficult for them?
Because, you know, you're quite often the very nature of organised crime is exploitative. It's very difficult to exploit those who are in secure financial situations. Criminal activity, whether it's illegal immigration operations, illegal prostitution operations, if there isn't a base of poverty, it's very difficult to exploit people. So if you tackle poverty and you tackle prohibition, you're actually undermining criminal enterprises in a way that increased police powers, increased police resources can never hope to do. And one of the guys I interviewed for the History of Organised Crime, there's an Albanian mafia organiser in the UK, a guy called Zef Nano, who was very closely involved in illegal immigration, drug running operations and illegal prostitution in the UK. And he was very clear and very explicit that he would not be able to thrive in terms of what he would see as entrepreneurship if there wasn't a base poverty which he was able to exploit for prostitution and immigration, and if there wasn't prohibition for the drugs. And so for him, the two biggest worries were taking those away, not increasing police powers, you know, not increasing police resources, police numbers. Those have very limited operational problems, which any big transnational criminal organisation can always get around by bribery, other routes, you know, redeploying resources. Actually tackling organised crime is much more fundamental, and it really requires real political bravery, real bravery by us as people to say, you know, we are going to refuse to engage in allowing that level of poverty to exist, that level of prohibition to exist, because those are what permit and allow organised criminal activity to thrive. You want to tackle organised crime, tackle poverty, tackle prohibition.
Your latest book, though, is Secrets and Lies, which is taking a little bit of a different tack, looking at various different conspiracies and giving a bit of a test as to seeing whether there's any basis to those conspiracies. Why did you decide you wanted to do that?
I think there's a huge literature now about conspiracy theory, and that's very interesting and it's very entertaining. But quite often it sidelines some of the very important issues. And what I wanted to do is write a book of what I call conspiracy fact. Things which, if you actually looked at them or were told about them, your natural inclination would be to dismiss them as absolutely impossible. These are mad conspiracy theories. But if you then actually went and did any basic research, having read the book and read any of the entries in it, you would actually be able to establish very simply, very quickly, very effectively, from authoritative, independent resources, that this was conspiracy fact. The operations which the CIA did, or an operation by the Catholic Church, or by a major corporation, which if I told you, you would naturally assume would be a mad, paranoid fantasy, is absolutely verifiable fact, and a matter of actual record, which is very easy for you, anybody, to go away and verify. And so I wanted to deal in a whole different literature, which was conspiracy fact, not conspiracy theory.
Why should anybody trust you? You were a spin doctor for the supermarket.
I've been a spin doctor for many organisations. I actually don't ask anybody to trust me. What I've been trying to do is lay out information. And I don't want people to actually take what you say, I say, or any other journalistic source necessarily will say as fact, as truth. We now live in an age of access to information where we as individual citizens can engage much more proactively in checking and verifying what we are told. And I think we've all got a duty to actually go away and verify and check and become our own researchers, become our own intelligence operations. Not just become the media, but become the bits behind the media which we don't often see. And actually check this stuff out for ourselves. What I tell you, or what you tell anybody, will never have the power of what they discover for themselves. And what I tried to do with Secrets and Lies was provide enough signposts in any given entry that somebody could go away, if their interest was actually taken by the story, go away and verify it for themselves.
But isn't that what the newspapers and journalists are supposed to do? Check these facts for the public. I mean, it's very difficult for every member of the public to go and check every fact in every story.
That's how it may have worked in the past. These days, I think we have a culture of lazy journalism. And certainly on a lot of the mainstream media, the level of fact-checking, the level of investigation in stories is actually of a lower quality than what you will find with a lot of citizen journalists. Not everybody has the resources, not everybody has the time to check everything. But make a start. If something interests you, pursue it, follow it, investigate. There is no hierarchy now which says what you will read or hear broadcast is going to be more verifiable, more accurate than what you can check for yourself. And engage with the stories that interest you. Check, research, follow. You haven't got the situation now where you can trust without question any source of media. And I don't want a populace, I don't want people that would trust any source of media, even an apparently independent source of media, and wouldn't want to engage and wouldn't be curious enough to actually do some research for themselves and to do some thinking for themselves. In Secrets and Lies, I was asked, I asked if I could write, you know, an afterword, and it was only actually going to be a few words, but they gave me 1,500. But it came down to, you know, the biggest lie you've been told is that you are powerless to affect change. And the biggest secret is why you actually then, when you realise you have a huge amount of power as an individual, don't act on it. And I really do believe that we're coming into a position now where our access to technology, the new type of networks which are evolving, really do give us all the opportunity to interrogate and investigate at a much higher level than we could do 30 years ago, 50 years ago, 70 years ago. And so if we go back to the type of journalism, the excellent journalism we used to see in the 30s, that's disappeared very largely from mainstream media. And if you want to actually go back to tracing that and being part of that, do it yourself.
Thank you very much to David Southwell there for being allowing himself to be interviewed, and what a very interesting chat. Certainly gives you pause for thought in terms of what I remember being told in history is the difference between primary, secondary and tertiary evidence. And I think there's just such a wealth of information out there, especially on the internet. Even if you do find it, you know, how is our education system equipping young people to be able to cope with this onslaught of media? It's all amazing. You know, you've got adverts in the street, you've got the internet, papers, radio, TV, you know, you've got live feeds coming in through your iPod. I remember media studies, certainly up to now, sort of being seen as a bit of an easy subject, but I think it's probably one of the most vital subjects for a young person to learn. And that certainly gives you a pause for thought, what he has to say.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. Okay.
Well, this is a single by Katraz. We interviewed him in previous weeks, if you're an eagle-eared listener and you remember. This is Knock Knock. You can check out his MySpace, which is /Katraz Music. And that's us in Alcatraz, obviously, C-A-T-R-A-Z. He's got a record deal. He's got his record out, but he's got to do all the promotion himself. It's worth looking up on YouTube. The video is good fun. This is Knock Knock by Katraz.
Because I like to stay real. I finally found what I was looking for when I heard Biggie Smalls. I started dancing with some Jillian and Dominican women, the colour of cinnamon, and I was swimming with the banner and I'm up, not. My name is Alcatraz. I came to rub up to your derriere in the spot, feeling you getting hot while we rock, bump and drop. Somebody rocking hip hop. Open up the front door, and maybe later on we open up a little bit more. But let's save that for later. From me start the taper, I feel like tonight's gonna be an earthquake. Latina women, they start singing, and I'm starting to tell them how I'm feeling. I tell them that I swallow the rhyme of thesaurus, that I'm a Taurus, and I just say words of rhyme until the chorus. They tell me I'm mad, crazy, complex, more sides than a hexagon. I said, you reckon? Well, I used to live in Brecon, then I got tired of the beacons, and I moved back to Clifton. You know what I'm mixing, I said, parties are beating, and some fast speakers throbbing, like the chest of a robin, and then we arrived, there were lights in the sky, the DJs run the classics like. They really start listening, their eyes start dancing, and I start pinching my skin and see if I keep them while I dance with the Chilean and Dominican women, the colour of cinnamon again. I'm swimming with the venom in the rock knock. My name is Alcatraz, I came to rub up to your derriere in the spot, feeling you getting hot while we rock, bump and drop. Somebody rocking hip hop, open up the front door, and maybe later on we open up a little bit more. But let's save that for later. When we start the taper, I feel like tonight's gonna be an earthquake. B-I-G, S-N-O-O-P, D-O-double-G, and beginning with N-W-A.
away from DRE. Hey. The next party that we came to was for the glass tables and white lines. Horses in the stable. And OKR. Saying OKR to the OKR friends. Comparing events as well. My friends ain't got no benzes.
No.
Most of them just trying to make me their enzes.
So.
I head back home where I'm chilling with a chili and a Dominican women, yeah.
Hey, knock, knock.
My name is Alcatraz. I came to rub up to your derriere, yeah, in a spot. Feeling you getting hot while we got pop and drop. Somebody rocking hip hop. Open up the front door.
That was Knock Knock by Katraz, and the very best of luck to him with promoting his new single.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, it's time for a little bit more local music. Should have said, I suppose, being Katraz, the track that played earlier, I mean, he's a local guy. This, too, is a very much local guy. Howlin' Lord, he's always playing, often in the Junction or in Mr. Wolf's. This is a track called Reunion Song, which is him recorded at the Black Heart Studios, which is basically in his house. And I can tell you, it's a phenomenal place. He's got his own room in his place that he rents, and it's absolutely chocker full of guitars and basses. It's quite formidable. And amps and speakers and posters of all the gigs that he's done all over the walls. It's amazing.
Do you really think it's right you're creeping me like an old friend? When my heart is the one that's twisted you're not been. Years will only have been kind to me when the past and our paths never crossed again. If I could forgive the way you can forget, you wouldn't seem so cruel for your absence of regret. Maybe I could stand to talk with you a while. I've learned not to give credence to your smile. I'm sorry, old girl, but your presence chills my bones. If I knew you were coming, I would have stayed home. Buy me a drink, plaster over the cracks. I still curse your name when you turn your back. I wish I knew better, but when you did me wrong, if I knew how to fight back, I could write a different song. I was naive, my nerves exposed. Sometime later, I got tough and old. Sorry, old girl, but your presence chills in my bones. If I knew you were coming, I would have stayed at home. Buy me a drink, plaster over the cracks. I still curse your name when you turn your back. History and shame that I cannot erase makes my blood run cold every time I see your face. I won't be dancing on your way. Things are better now you got away.
That was a reunion song from the Black Heart Sessions EP, available now. You can look it up on iTunes, and in fact, if you are in a band at the moment and, you know, you're sort of trying to get a record deal, check out a place called TuneCord.com. He told me, oh, well, you don't necessarily need an agent per se. What you do is get yourself from TuneCord.com, pay them about £11 a year, and they will release your tracks for you on iTunes, Amazon UK, and Amazon in the US. So you've got like the online sales bit done. Then all you really need to concentrate on is a PR and a booking agent. So it's a different way of looking into promoting yourself that's coming around these days. Do you necessarily need an agent or a record contract as such? How can you go around promoting your tune? So yeah, that's his method of doing it. And you can check out myspace.com/howlinlord, all one word, or of course you can just look him up on iTunes. Australian-born journalist John Pilger is probably best known for his epic ITV documentaries telling the hidden stories in conflict zones from Vietnam to the West Bank and Gaza in Israeli-occupied Palestine. His last film, The War on Democracy, has won several awards and is about the US's interventions in Latin America. But with the demise of ITV, so it is possible that the era of films has come to an end. As a man himself might say, though, never fear. Mr. Pilger's analysis of the first few months of the presidency of Barack Obama is just as fearless as his previous films. And we're bringing you his recent speech in Australia. And this is part 3 of 3. This is the last one this week. He looks at Obama's first 6 months and whether the hope offered by Obama is being fulfilled, or is it a forlorn fake hope?
Yes, a lot of good people mobilized for Obama. But what did they demand of him? Working to elect a Democratic presidential candidate may seem like activism, but it isn't. Activism doesn't give up. Activism doesn't fall silent. Activism doesn't rely on the opiate of hope. Woody Allen once said, "I felt a lot better when I gave up hope." Real activism has little time for identity politics, which, like exceptionalism, can be fake. These are distractions that confuse and sucker good people, and not only in the United States, I can assure you. I write for the Italian socialist newspaper Il Manifesto, or rather I used to write for it. In February I sent the editor an article which raised questions about Obama as a progressive force. The article was rejected. Why, I asked. "For the moment," wrote the editor, "we prefer to maintain a more positive approach to the novelty presented by Obama. We will take on specific issues, but we would not like to say that he will make no difference." Unquote. In other words, an American president drafted to promote the most rapacious system in history is ordained and depoliticized by important sections of the left. It's a remarkable situation. Remarkable because those on the so-called radical left have never been more aware, more conscious of the iniquities of power. The Green Movement, for example, has raised the consciousness of millions so that almost every child knows something about global warming. And yet, there seems to be a resistance within the Green Movement to the notion of power as a military force, a military project. And perhaps similar observations can also be made about sections of the feminist movement and the gay movement, and certainly the union movement. One of my favorite quotations is from Milan Kundera. "The struggle of people against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting." We should never forget that the primary goal of great power is to distract and limit our natural desire for social justice and equity and real democracy. Long ago, Edward Bernays's invisible government of propaganda elevated big business from its unpopular status as a kind of mafia to that of a patriotic driving force. The American way of life began as an advertising slogan. The modern image of Santa Claus was an invention of Coca-Cola. Today we are presented with an extraordinary opportunity. Thanks to the crash of Wall Street and the revelation for many ordinary people that the free market has nothing to do with freedom. The opportunity within our grasp is to recognize that something is stirring in America that is unfamiliar, perhaps, to many of us on the left, but is related to a great popular movement that's growing all over the world. Look down at Latin America. Less than 20 years ago, there was the usual despair, the usual divisions of poverty and freedom, the usual thugs in uniforms running unspeakable regimes. Today, for the first time perhaps in 500 years, there's a people's movement based on the revival of indigenous cultures and language, a genuine populism. The recent amazing achievements in Bolivia, Ecuador, Venezuela, El Salvador, Argentina, Brazil, and Paraguay represent a struggle for community and political rights that is truly historic, with implications for all of us. The successes in Latin America are expressed perversely in the recent overthrow of the government of Honduras, because the smaller the country, the greater is the threat of a good example that the disease of emancipation will spread. Indeed, right across the world, social movements and grassroots organizations have emerged to fight free market dogma. They've educated governments in the South that food for export is a problem rather than a solution to global poverty. They've politicized ordinary people to stand up for their rights, as in the Philippines and South Africa. Look at the remarkable boycott, disinvestment and sanctions campaign, BDS for short, aimed at Israel, that's sweeping the world. Israeli ships have been turned away from South Africa and Western Australia. A French company has been forced to abandon plans to build a railway connecting Jerusalem with illegal Israeli settlements. Israeli sporting bodies find themselves isolated. Universities in the United Kingdom have begun to sever ties with Israel. This is how apartheid South Africa was defeated. And this is how the great wind of the 1960s began to blow. And this is how every gain has been won. The end of slavery, universal suffrage, workers' rights, civil rights, environmental protection, the list goes on and on. And that brings us back here to the United States. As I believe, something is stirring in this country. Are we aware that in the last eight months, millions of angry emails sent by ordinary Americans have flooded Washington? And I mean millions. People are outright outraged that their lives are attacked. They bear no resemblance to the passive mass presented by the media. Look at the polls. More than two-thirds of Americans say the government should care for those who cannot care for themselves. 64% would pay higher taxes to guarantee health care for everyone. 60% are favorable towards unions. 70% want nuclear disarmament. 72% want the US completely out of Iraq, and so on and so on. But where is much of the left? Where is the social justice movement? Where is the peace movement? Where is the civil rights movement? Ordinary Americans for too long have been misrepresented by stereotypes that are contemptuous. James Madison referred to his compatriots in the public as ignorant and meddlesome outsiders. And this contempt is probably as strong today among the elite as it was back then. That's why the progressive attitudes of the public are seldom reported in the media, because they're not ignorant, they're subversive, they're informed, and they're even anti-American. I once asked a friend, the great American war correspondent and humanitarian Martha Gellhorn, to explain the term anti-American to me. "I'll tell you what anti-American is," she said in her forceful way. "It's what governments and their vested interests call those who honor America by objecting to war and the theft of resources and believing in all of humanity. There are millions of these anti-Americans in the United States. They are ordinary people." They are ordinary people who belong to no elite and who judge their government in moral terms, though they would call it common decency. They are not vain. They are the people with a wakeful conscience, the best of American citizens, of America's citizens. Sure, they disappear from view now and then, but they are like seeds beneath the snow. I would say they are truly exceptional. Truly exceptional. I like that. My own guess is that a populism is growing once again in America, evoking a powerful force beneath the surface which has a proud history. From such authentic grassroots Americanism came women's suffrage, the eight-hour day, graduated income tax, public ownership of railways and communications, the breaking of the power of corporate lobbyists, and much more. In other words, real democracy. The American populace were far from perfect, but they often spoke for ordinary people, and they were betrayed by leaders who urged them to compromise and merge with the Democratic Party. That was long ago, but how familiar it sounds. My guess is that something is coming again. The signs are there. Noam Chomsky is right when he says that mere sparks can ignite a popular movement that may seem dormant. No one predicted 1968. No one predicted the fall of apartheid, or the Berlin Wall, or the civil rights movement, or the great Latino rising of a few years ago. I suggest that we take Woody Allen's advice and give up on hope and listen instead to voices from below. What Obama and the bankers and the generals and the IMF and the CIA and CNN and BBC fear is ordinary people coming together and acting together. It's a fear as old as democracy, a fear that suddenly people convert their anger to action, as they've done so often throughout history. At a time of universal deceit, wrote George Orwell, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. Thank you.
That was Australian journalist, author, and New Statesman magazine columnist John Pilger.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Right, there's another local band we've had in previous weeks. This is the Surf and Turnips. We interviewed one of their guys. They've got a new album out at the moment, which is called Return to Turbo Island, which anyone wandering up Stokescroft will be more than familiar with. It's recently renovated by the People's Republic at Stokescroft and all their yellow paintwork. This is a track called Beast of Bodmin.
I can't get away. I started with a trepidation. Now he's did it with annihilation. Cause I know I can't get away. I hear the call of the beast of Bodmin. I know I can't get away. There were lambings I'm in May, and me folks had gone away. And now the beast of Bodmin's out to play. This one thing you gotta be told, this land be ancient, land be
cruel and I know I can't get away. When the mist descend on the hill, they hoist Benny for Garden Hills, and I know I can't get away. I hear the call of the beast of Bodmin, I know I can't get away. For loving, taming me, and me folks have gone away, and now the beast of Bodmin's out to play. Where men be men, the sheep be scared, I think I find this forgotten lair, and I know I can't get away. 6'6" with eyes of green, I think he wants my aubergine, and I know I can't get away. I hear the call of the beast of Bodmin, I know I can't get away. For loving, timing me, and me folks have gone away. Now the beast of Bodmin's out to play. I hear the call of the beast of Bodmin, I know I can't get away. For loving, timing me, and my folks have gone away. And now the beast of Bodmin's out to play.
Lots of cider themes predominant in their music. That's the Surfing Turnips from their album Return to Turbo Island. I'd like to welcome to the studio, in a typically joyful mood, Mr. Jeff Sparks. Hello.
Hello, John.
Let's chat briefly. You went on a very long walk last Friday. Why did you do that?
It was for Grand Intentions, which was an initiative for the National Autistic Society, where I've got to raise £1,000 to support the charity. And last Friday I did a 25.5 mile walk from Bristol to Glastonbury.
Now, I don't know you as a man that's raring to go with super exercise like tennis and cycling and cliff climbing. So that must have been a hell of a feat. Were you a bit daunted?
Was a bit worried, yes, but I've been doing a bit of keep fit lately, going to the gymnasium, and felt, you know, after doing that, I felt, you know, I could do this walk.
Congratulations. Now, tell us, what's going on this week?
Thank you. This is your What's On Guide from Dialector Radio. Starting with Friday, 18th of September, and the Wild Hearts will be performing with support from Black Spiders and No Americana at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 6:30pm and tickets are £14 in advance. Moving on to Saturday, 19th of September, the Men They Couldn't Hang will be performing with support from AFGM at Fiddler's in Bristol. Doors open at 7:30pm and tickets are £12 in advance. On to Song of the Week and the feature Kiss. This group formed in 1972 and they are still touring and recording to this day, with a new album out next month. This is a track from the album Revenge, which was released in 1992 and is titled Domino.
Let me tell you my story. I got a man-sized predicament, and it's a big one. Goes like this, yeah. Virgin Mary. damn thing. And that bitch bends over, and I forget my name. Ow.
That was Kiss with Domino from the album Revenge. For more information on Kiss, you can check out www.kissonline.com. Staying with 19th of September, and Flash Harry will be performing at the Old Duke in Bristol. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. Finally, on to Sunday, 20th of September, Fab 208 will be performing at the Portcullis, which is at 130 High Street, Steeple Hill in Bristol. The gig starts at 4 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Poetry Cairns Bristol Poetry Festival, which finished on September 13th, was one of the highlights of the city's summer. You may see the summer poetry season as the poor relation of the more populist music festivals like WOMAD and Glastonbury, but it did give us some unusual events like the Bristol Dead Poets Slam at the Lansdowne Pub. Dialect's Katie Austin went up to Clifton to see what a poetry slam is like and thought she'd make the most of the experience by reading something as well.
Slam sounds a bit more like a kind of baseball game or a tennis tournament to me than a poetry festival.
Well, it's an American term because the slam poetry movement started in America.
Right.
So maybe that's where the baseball analogy comes from. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's competitive poetry, so the contenders have 3 minutes to present their stuff, and you've got a panel of judges who mark their... give a mark from on their presentation. So it can work through a series of rounds that you're it's quite intense.
Descend, you know, descend and sing. The breathing instruments inspire. Wake into voice each silent string and sweep the sounding lyre. In a sadly pleasing strain, let the warbling lutes complain. Let the loud trumpet sound till the roots all abound. The shrill echoes rebound, while in more lengthened notes and slow, the deep, majestic, sullen organs blow. Hark!
I knew a man who used to say, not once, but 20 times a day, that in the turmoil and the strife, his very words of public life, the thing of ultimate
effect was character! Okay, Katie, what happens is that the three poets who got the highest scores in round one are going through to the second round, and we'll have another poem from each of those, and then the poet who's judged the best out of those three will be the winner of the Bristol Poetry Dead Poets Slam for 2009, and they will, after the little ceremony where they'll get a huge round of applause and a little tiny prize, they will get to do a final poem just so that everyone can hear one last poem from the favourite dead poet of 2009.
There was quite a range of poets present, and I've got a feeling that every single poetry slam will be different. So would I recommend this to anybody else? Yeah, I think I would. not just if you love poetry, and in fact, perhaps not if you like poetry, because it's a good way of getting into it, and Bristol's actually a really vibrant scene for the people who go out there and speak the word in local cafes, pubs, events like this. You do have to look out for them, because it's not the kind of event that's posted everywhere. But if you look up Poetry Can on the internet, you can find a whole list of events that are around the city.
That was Katie Austin there, going along to a Poetry Slam, and if you want to hear slams of new poems, pop down to the Halo Cafe, which is at number 141 Gloucester Road, every 2 weeks for their acoustic night. So the next one is on September the 21st, from about 7:45. Or you can subscribe to Poetry Can newsletters and find more events near you at www.poetrycan.org. And thank you very much to Katie Austin. Time now for our story of the week. As ever, it's Mr. John Fothergill and his diary, an innkeeper's diary. Back in the 1920s, out of the need to earn a living, he moved to Thame near Oxfordshire and ran the Spread Eagle Inn, starting in 1922. And the people and the customs he came across were not what he was expecting or used to, so he wrote this diary. And here is Malcolm Greaves reading it.
An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. Nothing now disturbs my nerves. Not the patronising, not the third rater, not the person who says, "What fun you must have had in getting it all like this." Or, "I suppose you get a lot of motorists passing through, when I like to think that this inn is a cul-de-sac." Or, "If you find a table gone, you'll know who," etc. Or the man who says, when you ask him where he would like to sit, "It's all the same to me," when I would like him to be embarrassed for a choice that you wouldn't get at an ABC. Or the person who, when looking round, asks, "Is this a very old house?" thus seeming to give credit to the house, and not to me for the filling of it. Because I know now that it's all meant pleasantly. Words which are only rather ordinary rings on which good feelings are born. But only the occasional Oxford lad who brings a shop girl disturbs me. This evening, two of them brought girls of that type, in my opinion, and that of the Boldero's charming folks who sat next to them. The lads were rather squits. Before they went, I said, "Are these girls sisters or fiancées?" "No, nothing to do with us." "And then I don't think I should bring them here again, as they're not in keeping with the place, nor indeed yourselves." The lads took it quietly, perhaps rather hurt. But in this peculiar situation near Oxford, it must be done, and I hate it. After all, we have the respect of dons and heads of colleges and all the best undergraduates, whilst our sons will go to proper schools. These shop girls must not come and spoil the show. It's one thing or the other. Barcenas, Argentinian, came to lunch. He used to come 4 years ago with a young foreign grandee, A.B., whose great-uncle, a greater grandee I used to know in Rome, and whose lovely beds, 1 8-feet long, I have slept in for 20 years, and have now thrown open to the lucky public. A.B. was quite the most beautiful youth we've ever had, with his almost Mongolian face, knowledge of food and wine, and wonderful manners. He held sumptuous parties here, and would afterwards escort them all down to my cellar. "Do you like brandy?" to one, and with a lovely gesture, "Take 3 bottles. "Do you like Chateau de Chem? "Take 4 bottles, and so on. And they exuded loaded from below. He left Oxford, and my bill, which his mother very graciously paid, mildly reproaching me for letting him have so much credit, which I felt deeply. I replied that I couldn't very well tell him in the cellar before his friends that he shouldn't buy the stuff, even if I had known that he couldn't afford it, which I didn't. And so ended my giving credit to undergraduates, which is distasteful in any case. It's bad enough to take their money at all. Edinger dined. This curly-haired, angel-faced little man, when at Oxford a year or two ago, billed a town that Professor Emil Busch would lecture on psychoanalysis, took and filled the town hall, and, assuming a beard and a slight German accent, lectured in his own manner to undergrads, dons, and heads of colleges, quoting German colleagues who never existed in non-existent universities, at whose mention the dons respectfully clapped. And then the game was exposed in the Cherwell an hour afterwards, and he was never found out. He and his friends have just come through Gloucestershire, and yesterday in a small village they asked the lady standing outside a good and very antique house where they could stay. She said there was nowhere, but asked them to stay at her house, and did them very well. The friend said that, owing to the uncanniness of such hospitality, he felt like walking in his sleep on the way up to the door. Sweet and dry wine. Dr. Rouse looked like a ship's captain, not a don and schoolmaster. A perfectly charming, kind little man, and like dons, full of funny stories and uncommonly secretive about himself. I told him that I thought only those people who liked sweet wine had the right to prefer dry, and he said he liked this doctrine because it suggested that only those who were wicked had the right to be good, a consolation for sinners. If you want to drink a lot of wine at a meal, a dry wine is the thing. But a good sweet wine is as good and better if you don't drink much. I got some confirmation of my theory that this dry wine preference is generally only a prejudice from a girl's telling me that when she came out, her parents said to her, "Now, when you are asked what you would like to drink, say it does not matter what, provided it be dry." The result is that good dry wine is hard to get, and good sweet wine is dear or unprocurable, because it has been turned into dry wine to supply the demand. 50 years ago, claret and sweet wine were drunk. Then, to supply the demand, the merchants deteriorated the quality so much that people had to turn over to Burgundy and Graves, and now the same has happened to these, and what was a palate persists as a prejudice. The first undergraduate party this term to dinner, Corpus Christi College. After dinner I found one on the roof of the stables, and I swore at him so much that he almost fell off. Then I gave him a lecture on the desirability of keeping this place nice, and the danger of precedence. I told him that I didn't think of them here as undergraduates or collegiates, as the locals call them, but decent people, like the rest of the folks who come here. The worst of it is, since Oxford, save for the dons, is a moving population, I shall have to keep up this old hen-and-chickens pedagogue attitude so long as I am here. The result of the lecture was that the roof scaler and two others promised to come here on their honeymoons. Not, I hoped, to be spent on the roof.
Well, that's the act of Malcolm Greaves, and thank you very much to him as ever and his wonderful honey tones, and it's always a pleasure to hear him reading pretty much anything, really. Well, thank you very much for listening. That's all we've got time for this week. Thank you very much to Tony Gosling and Anthea Page for their efforts, and Chris Erling Charles and David Southwell for being interviewed. Thank you to Katie Austin for her poetry feature, and hopefully we'll hear more from her. Thank you to Jeffrey Sparks for providing the What's On, and today Mark Condon for doing the engineering. I'm John Peters Coleman, and I've been producing this week. If you want to get in touch with us because you want to, you know, kind of take part in community radio, you don't know what it's about, you fancy having a go, you can always just sort of come down and join us. We're near Queen Square, right in the city centre, and you can just sort of hang out and see what you can contribute. Google Volunteering Bristol and get in touch with them, or you can ring them on 0117 989 7733. You can always email us, bristolradiocoop@hotmail.com, or check us out, dialectradio.co.uk. What a plethora of information. We're supposed to be having really nice weather at the moment, so let's hope the Indian summer continues.